You're listening to Now I've Heard Everything, conversations with the icons of our time.
People can relate to animal stories. It's a fun thing. Everybody relates to animals, both as far as stories or visiting a zoo, and I think that's what's really fun about a zoo.
Famed Columbus Zoo Director Jack Hanna. Today on Now I've Heard Everything, I'm Bill Thompson. Well, who doesn't enjoy going to the zoo? I mean, after all, the experience of being able to see wild or exotic animals up close is an experience everyone enjoys. But the modern zoo bears little resemblance to the old-style zoos that we or our parents or our grandparents used to visit. You know, the ones with small iron bar cages with hard concrete floors. They smelled bad. Now, modern zoos have replaced all that with much more open, natural habitat-looking enclosures for the animals. And one of the principal architects of that change was the longtime director of the Columbus Zoo, Jack Hanna. He took over an aging and decrepit and run-down zoo and turned it into a showplace that now attracts thousands and thousands of visitors. And along the way, Jack Hanna became something of a media celebrity. During the 80s and 90s, you could see him everywhere on late-night TV, on morning shows. He was on television all over the place and would always bring some sort of exotic animal with him. Now, I met him in 1989 when he wrote his autobiography called Monkeys on the Interstate. And what did he bring with him when I met him? In a few minutes, you're going to hear a Madagascar hissing cockroach. So here now, from 1989, Jack Hanna.
Monkeys on the Interstate was taken when I first came to Columbus Zoo and was trying to build a zoo that was under the sewers and drains department and trying to make an impression on people. And so I had the great idea of putting these snow monkeys out on a monkey island, which I thought would work. But one of my downfalls, I didn't read that much up on the snow monkeys. I knew they were swimmers, but not excellent swimmers. They swim underwater, on top of water, in cold water, whatever. So I filled them all up with water. They left a hose. Somebody left a hose in the moat. The monkeys escaped. They weigh about 30 pounds apiece. And to make a long story short, over a six-month period, we chased these monkeys all from Columbus, Ohio, all the way up Interstate 71 to Cleveland. And both monkeys, by the way, were separated by about 3 miles. And yet they both went north on Interstate 71, which was how that book got the title. Also, one day we had them on a golf course. We almost had them caught. We dressed up like golfers, the keepers and myself, and put the tranquilizer gun in the golf bag and actually finished our hole before we tried to chase the monkey down and shoot him. And we never caught him. I even tried to put a female monkey out to bring the males to the female. But if I did that, then I'd have baby monkeys all over the place. And it just one story after another, and that's how the book got its title.
People are fascinated by animal stories, aren't they?
They really are. I think people can relate to animal stories. It's a fun thing. People of all ages relate to animal stories. Not just people of all ages, but children, kids that are blind, deaf. Everybody relates to animals, both as far as stories or visiting a zoo. And I think that's what's really fun about a zoo.
The zoo business has really changed a lot since you first got in, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. The zoo business, I've been in it 20 years now, and I would say the difference, there's several main differences. One of the main differences in the zoo business is that 15, 20 years ago, it was a menagerie. The key was to be one-upsmanship, get as many animals as you can. Today, that's not the situation. Today, we have more specimens of a certain species. In other words, we're concentrating more on certain animals, and yet we don't have so many of a certain type of species, if you follow what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. Columbus does very well. The Columbus Zoo does very well with gorillas, cheetahs, those animals. We don't do very much with birds right now, and other zoos do better with other animals. The National Zoo just built an insectarium, the Cincinnati Zoo, and I think that's going to be the key to animal survival in the future, is that we concentrate on certain things and do it well. If not, the animals don't have a chance.
And it's no longer, when I was a kid, we went to the Brookfield Zoo in Chicago, and cage, and here's this animal on concrete
exactly.
Behind bars. Here's,
one animal in each cage,
mm-hmm.
Not two, right?
Mm-hmm. And that's all different now.
It's all different because it takes obviously two animals or two of anything to breed. And right now we're finding not only does it take two, it takes large social groups. And it's very important that we do that. And it's very expensive now. A good zoo, there are no more really bad zoos. The public has put their foot down. They're only good zoos now. And most of those good zoos all are going to natural habitat type areas, not just for the animal, but also for the people to understand what that animal is living in.
Our concept of what a zoo should be has changed over the years, hasn't it?
Right. You no longer take popcorn or candy or pebbles and throw them at the hippos or the animals at the zoo. Sure, some people do that because they're not educated enough. But our whole concept really about a zoo is to bring a person into a situation that's entertainment and have them leave that zoo being educated. That's a good zoo. When they can go to that zoo, you're not going to tell your kids, let's go to the zoo to be educated. They've done that all week in school. They're going to go there to have a fun time. And then when they leave the zoo, they're going to say, boy, I didn't know the giraffe had the same number of vertebrate as a human being. But they learn that off the signage. They learn that from our volunteers that teach them that. It's a total, at the Columbus Zoo, we now have 16 classrooms. I have 21 full-time teachers that we teach them from the age of 3 up to the age of 80. So it's education, education, education. Zoos can only breed so many animals. We can only do so much. What we're trying to do is educate the public so that they can help preserve wildlife in the wild. That's the key to a good zoo.
And does every taxi driver and air traffic controller now know that you have a zoo
in the Columbus? Well, I would hope that every taxi driver knows where the Columbus Zoo is. They should by now. At first, as you say in the book, they didn't quite know where the Columbus Zoo was. But now I think
it was a mess when you got there, wasn't it?
It was, the zoo was under the sewers and drains department, which really makes a lot of sense. But really, even back then, really, zoos in a lot of cities, they were there to provide a certain type of function for that city and not to cause any problems. And today, the cities now can see what a good zoo can do for that city in many, many ways. A zoo is just as important as the arts, as a symphony. It often amazes me that a Rembrandt or a particular artwork can bring millions of dollars, and yet a living creature, which is almost extinct, people now are beginning to appreciate that living creature almost extinct just as much as that Rembrandt. If you follow, you're talking about a living creature that's going into extinction versus a painting which is not living. I mean, I think there's a difference there. I'm not down on the arts because I'm a member of the arts in Columbus, but I think people are appreciating now more what that means. A zoo director or a zoo keeper is appreciated more in their community. When I came to Columbus, if you read in the book there, that someone said, boy, I wonder if he smells, when I went to my first party. You know, a zoo director now is just as good as an art director or a symphony director or anyone else. And I think people are also seeing that.
And your job is not just to feed the animals each morning and make sure that they have a bath in the evening. It goes way, way beyond that, doesn't it?
Way beyond it. In our zoo alone, we have 18 careers. 18 different careers. It's not just a zoo director or a veterinarian or a curator or a keeper. It's a public relations. It's education. It's horticulture. It's architects. It's landscape design. It goes on and on, the different careers we have there. And, of course, that's why we have so many different people. We have 190 people that work for the Columbus Zoo. And you know, it's a pretty large staff. So it's a big business. It's promotion, as you also read. It's constant. At our zoo, we don't spend a dime on promotion or on advertising, radio or TV. And yet we're always out there. You know, every zoo director has their own forte. Mine happens to be education through entertainment. Walt Disney said, he had a quote about education and entertainment. He does a very good job at entertaining and educating at the same time. And that's what we do at the Columbus Zoo, I think, very, very well. And that's what I'm good at.
After this short break, Jack Hanna introduces me to a very strange creature.
Start your day with Now I've Heard Everything.
We post new episodes every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 5 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time.
Subscribe now so you'll have something fresh to listen to and get your day going.
Now back to my 1989 interview with Jack Hanna.
You have to be careful, though, that in the course of a promotion, that you don't exploit or endanger these animals.
Exactly, and that's something that I have to answer to, and I have to go to bed with every night when I do a show, whether it's Letterman or Good Morning America or whatever show that may be. I have to leave that show knowing that somewhere someone's been educated. In my 20 years that I know of, we have never injured an animal. We have never really ever bastardized an animal. And you don't want to do that. Animals are themselves. All animals we take back to our zoo go back into a breeding situation. And I have taken some criticism from some of my cohorts, not many, but some, who think that it's anthropomorphism. In other words, comparing people to animals. Well, I think all of us will always compare people to animals. If we don't, I think we have a very serious problem there, because people can relate that way. Some zoos, very few zoos, don't name their animals. You know, that to me is, we'll always name animals, no matter who you are. Our keepers, our staff name their animals because it's like they're children. They work with these animals every single day, and it's an issue that's brought up once in a while, but I have no problem defending my way of doing things.
You really can't be in your line of work without having just a tad anthropomorphological.
Yeah, that's a good word, right? It's a tough word.
I mean, you really have to have that trait, don't you, to be a good zookeeper, a good curator?
Yes, you do, because you're not only working with animals, you're working with human beings, with people. And I think those zoo people, and there are very few, there are not many, but there are those zoo people who just think it's just the animals, animals, animals. And it can't be that way. Because if we don't get to the people that are in Africa poaching the elephant, or the people that are in India poaching the Asian elephant, or the people that are who knows where killing what animal in what country or continent, then we're not doing our job. And you have to work with people. The people have to understand that if these animals disappear, the next thing to go is are the people themselves. And I've been very fortunate in my 20 years to visit 10, 12 countries in Africa over the years and seen what has happened to those people who don't appreciate their wildlife. If you don't appreciate your resources and cut down your forest, as we all have heard, you have loss of wildlife. When you have loss of resources, you have loss of wildlife, you have loss of human life. So it doesn't take a doctor or a real intelligent person to figure all this out. You just see it with your own eyes.
Now, when we see you on television, you're wrestling with an animal. They're trying to keep it under control in the hot lights. And
I brought you my hissing cockroach. I wanted you to hear this. I'm going to leave this with you because I wanted you to. I don't think you'll run off your table there. Just don't even go. I don't even breathe in your. He won't hurt you or anything. You can hold up to your mic.
We had a story about these the other day. I heard there's some guy who's selling these as pets.
Exactly, and they're not a regular cockroach. Now, see, he likes you. He stopped.
Which end out of is he hissing?
The front end, but he stopped now because he likes your arm. But that cockroach is about 4 inches long.
Take that both ways, I guess.
Yeah.
My wife would go crazy if she saw what I'm doing.
Oh, she would. She wouldn't like that at all.
The kids would love it.
But that's kind of like my calling card. The kids do. You know, I can go to a...
You're very energetic.
There you go. He's kissing me again. We're putting back in my pocket. But it's an easy little pocket critter for me to carry around if I have to get on the plane and go for my interviews.
That's a very effective way to combat disrespectful stewardesses, too, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah, you can take care of them real quick. Or if you're at a restaurant, you're going to have a meal.
Look what I found
my bread basket. You know, we'll give you a free meal. So that works very well, too.
Now, we all get a good laugh out of when you're on the on TV and you're trying to control these animals. And we all, the thought that always goes through my mind is, my gosh, what is he going to do? I mean, how is he going to bring that snake under control? Or you know, how's he going to handle that ocelot or whatever you bring on TV?
Well, doing what I do is like I like to get things done quickly. And when you're on there, if you're on national TV, whatever TV show, you're trying to get quite a bit done in a little time. In other words, there are zoo directors and people who do a great job at a slower pace than I do. Joan Embry, Jim Fowler, all these people do a tremendous job on the shows they do. I have a different way of doing it, and it's, again, through entertainment. But I do have a lot of animals. Of course, all my staff are there. There's always one keeper for every single animal. I don't care if it's a cockroach or a toad. There's always one person responsible for that animal. So it looks like it might be a little chaotic when I'm on, but everybody has their eyes on whatever little creature. So I can't really take a timber wolf on with a rabbit. You know, I would have total disaster.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah. predator-prey type relationship.
Have you ever looked back and in any way had any regret at all about what you've chosen to do for a living?
No, you know, that's a very good question. I think for young people who ask that question a lot about how do you get into a zoo work or how do you get into wildlife, you must understand several things. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There is no day off, whether it's an earthquake, Easter, Christmas. Those animals rely on you, just like your pet at home. And if you're willing to make that sacrifice, there's no greater self-satisfaction that anyone could have other than working not just with wild animals, but with domestic animals as well. And you're not going to become a millionaire or very wealthy. But again, you will be very self-satisfied, and it's a very competitive field now. There are only 4,200 people employed in the zoo business in this country. That's from the man who picks up the trash, or even from the zoo director down, up or down, whatever. 4,200 people. Every zoo could fit in the borough of Manhattan in this country, 160 zoos. So there's not much property, so to speak, land allowed for our Earth's creatures. And there's only 4,200 of us, so it's a small field, 65 major zoo directors. And so, you know, if you screw up, there's not very many places to go. But my best advice to anyone who wants to get into it, going into college or out of college, yes, a degree is important. You must have one. But it's hands-on experience. It's getting out there and volunteering, as I did as a little boy for a veterinarian for 4 years with no pay, or going to a humane society or humane shelter, or going to a horse farm or a farm. Get that hands-on experience, and then you'll know if you really want to commit your life to conservation and to animals. Plus, it takes a dedicated family. I have three daughters at home and a wife and a castrated dog, so there's not very many male animals at my house. But, you know, you walk home and you, like last week, we found a kangaroo hanging on a doorknob and 12 ducks in the bathtub and a bunch of rabbits in the kitchen. So that's the kind of fun life that I do have. But I think that the key to it is that every city in this country that has a zoo, be thankful you have a zoo and support your zoo by visiting your zoo. You don't have to donate large dollars. Just visit your zoo, and that's the best thing you can do to help preserve wildlife.
Jack Hanna is 77 now. He and his wife live in Montana, and a couple of years ago, Jack was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Now, you can get a copy of Monkeys on the Interstate by Jack Hanna by tapping the link in our show notes, or by going to our website, heardeverything.com. We may earn an Amazon commission if you make a purchase. Also, while you're at heardeverything.com, don't miss my 2007 interview with the widow of Steve Irwin, Terry Irwin.
He didn't look at an animal and say, that could rip my head off, or, gee, that's the most venomous snake on earth. He appreciated and admired its beauty and its adaptability and just genuinely loved it, and I never saw him scared of anything.
And my 1990 conversation with the legendary Jane Goodall.
When I was a child, I had two dreams. One was to study animals, work with them, learn about them, preferably in Africa. And the other was to write books about them. So how fortunate I've been that those dreams have come true.
And of course, we post new episodes of Now I've Heard Everything every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and you can find us everywhere you listen to podcasts. And thank you so much for listening. Next time on Now I've Heard Everything, she was for many decades a leading advocate for the blind in America, a leader in the fight for the rights of the disabled. My 1988 conversation with Rose Resnick.
You see, the word blindness is an emotion-packed word. It's very scary to people. It's very repelling, the thought of it. Because, unfortunately, the stereotype is that blindness is associated with helplessness and sexlessness and lots of things that we don't like.
That's next time on Now I've Heard Everything. I'm Bill Thompson.